Iran and the P4 Plus One group resumed talks on the revival of JCPOA in Vienna. Tehran says removing U.S. sanctions is its red line in the negotiations. Iran's leader points to U.S. miscalculations and says Americans are receiving blows from an area they never suspected. Israeli forces killed three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a move that Palestinians condemn as a field execution. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Now, starting our special coverage, Iran, the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal, resumed talks in the Austrian capital in a bid to revive the accord. The eighth round of the negotiations reconvened Tuesday following a 10-day break. And that because negotiators from Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries, that's Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, had returned to the capitals for consultations. Meantime, Iranian and Russian foreign ministers stressed on a phone call on the importance of correct implementation of the accord, known as the JCPOA. Sergey Lavrov and Amin Abdullahian also called for the restoration of the 2015 deal in its original form as soon as possible. The Vienna talks are focused on the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and bring Islamic Republic back to its commitments under JCPOA. The U.S. is not directly involved in those talks since it withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions, leaving the deal in limbo. All right, to discuss the topic, I'm joined by a couple of guests, our own correspondent, Tomas Lesgi, joining us from Vienna. Also from Vienna, we have Heinz Segertner, political scientist with the International Institute for Peace. Okay, let's go to Tomas first. So the talks have started, Tomas, as I was talking to you an hour ago. So the drafts are there, and Tehran was saying that it's the political decision that needs to be made by the other sides, because Iran has made everything crystal clear, and things are laid out there. So it's the other side, especially the U.S., that needs to make their decisions. Let's see what's happening there.
Yes, Behrouz, you just said there in the news story that there was a phone conversation between the Iranian and Russian foreign ministers here in Vienna. There is also a meeting between the Iranian and the Russian sides led by the heads of the delegations, the deputy foreign ministers, Mr. Ali Bagheri from Iran and Ambassador Mikhail Oyanov from the Russian side, and this after Mr. Bagheri's meeting with EU coordinator Enrique Mora. Now, as you said, what the Iranians are saying is that they expect specifically, especially the Americans, to come back to these talks with the necessary political decisions made. They believe that if the Americans make the decisions when it comes to the scope of sanctions relief, guarantees and verification that have been agreed upon in principle, then things can move forward. What we mean by that is that, of course, all the participants have said that they understand and sympathize with this Iranian demand that there should be guarantees or that there should be assurances that the U.S. will not withdraw from the deal again, and that there should be assurances that the sanctions will be effectively removed. But how is that going to be worded in the agreement? That is something that's up for discussion. And how far is the U.S. willing to go to give that assurance and to give the guarantees? Is it going to be acceptable to the Iranians? Also, when it comes, as we said earlier, to the sanctions, is the U.S. team going to remove all of the sanctions that Iran wants removed in order to be come back to full implementation? What we know up until this stage is most of the technical work has been done, a lot of the draft has been prepared, but until these issues are not resolved, we're not going to have a successful conclusion of these talks. We'll have to see if that's going to happen. And this break, as you said, was meant for these important political decisions that needed to be made at the high levels. But we are hearing that what maybe is stopping the Biden administration from agreeing to these demands may be divisions in within the administration of Biden himself, and also what he faces when it comes to the Congress or the Senate, you know, the pressure that he's facing from Republicans on the issue of restoring the JCPOA with Iran. They did waive some sanctions that were nuclear related, of course, Iran saying that that is not enough, and just agreeing to waive some sanctions on paper is not going to be enough for the restoration of the deal. Iran wants the effective removal of those sanctions.
Okay. Now, let me ask Heinz Gertner. Heinz, given this division that you see, and also Homa mentioned it, within the U.S. authorities, and do you believe that the Joe Biden administration is really serious? Because they had only the sanctions waiver, and that had to do with only the nuclear research and that kind of thing. What Iran wants is to be able to economically benefit from the deal. That's what the deal is almost all about. So how do you see the prospect?
Now, first of all, I do think the Biden administration wants to have an agreement at JCPOA. It is true there is resistance in the Congress, and there are opponents to any agreement, the opponents to any negotiations. But we have seen this before. Before 2015, there was strong opposition in the Congress against the JCPOA and against Obama's policy towards the JCPOA. And after all, the JCPOA has been adopted. So there's a very similar situation right now, of course. And when it comes to Iran's request to remove sanctions, that's true. But the Biden administration signaled already that it's ready to remove some sanctions. So we have seen this with these nuclear waivers the Biden administration announced, which are related to the peaceful nuclear civilian program of Iran and not directly related to the JCPOA. However, and of course, Iran has the right to use civilian nuclear technology, and President Trump violated this non-proliferation right for Iran. And now Biden is going to restore some of these nuclear waivers, which is a good signal. Of course, more sanctions have to be removed, but after all, would benefit, and from a JCPOA, the Biden administration would benefit because it would stop the fear of further proliferation, nuclear proliferation in the Middle East, and Iran would benefit from the relief of economic sanctions. And what I have seen, Iran has some priorities already, removing sanctions in the oil sector, financial sector. Of course, more has to become. And your correspondent mentioned also this agreement in Vienna, while the delegations have been in their capitals, and I assume political decisions already have been made there. Experts have been have remained in Vienna, and they drafted a text with the remaining issues. And this text is getting, these remaining issues are getting smaller and smaller, and there seems to be a broad agreement on verification of Iran's nuclear program done by the IAEA, but also verification of the sanction relief. So there are some technical issues left. Of course, the guarantees that the next president should not renege, this is an open question, and also the implementation, the sequencing, this still has to be discussed as well.
Okay, let's see what will come out of it. Thanks for that, Homa. Let's get our correspondent in Vienna, and Heinz Gertner, political scientist with International Institute for Peace, also in Vienna, with their comments and contribution for this special edition. Now, moving on, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says that the enemy has launched a multifaceted offensive against Iran, from politics and economy to security, media, and diplomacy. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iran cannot always maintain a defensive strategy in the face of such vast hostility. It should also go on the offensive in different areas, such as security, economy, and media. He also noted that Western powers claim that they advocate freedom of expression, but in fact resort to media dictatorship. He cited the censorship of social media posts on Lieutenant General Soleimani, Iran's anti-terror icon, who was assassinated by the U.S. in 2020. The leader said that Western powers place a media ban on every word or image that runs counter to their policies, but use the same platforms to unleash destructive offensives against the Islamic Republic. The leader also said that Washington's calculations have turned out to be wrong.
Well,
The leader added that the definitive policy of media hostile to Iran and Islam is to distort the image of the Islamic Revolution. He said that enemies are trying to conceal the realities, achievements, and advances that Iran has made since the victory of the 1979 revolution, and instead exaggerate the weak points 100-fold. He called on Iranian officials to counter this campaign by publicizing and broadcasting numerous achievements the country has made in different sectors. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with a group of commanders and staff of the Air Force. The meeting marks the historic declaration of allegiance of the Iranian Air Force officers with the late founder of the Islamic Republic, late Imam Khomeini, back on February 8, 1979. Okay, now from Madison, let me bring in Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert. Kevin, so you heard the leader's comments, and the one highlight of his comments is the miscalculation on the part of Washington, and it's been going on. Do you think that they will stop actually this and kind of open their eyes and ears to realities on the ground in Iran so that they can make proper decisions, including what's happening in Vienna?
Yes, I was saying that a senior Israeli IDF commander, I believe it was Ronan Bergman or another senior Israeli journalist, that our problem is that we believe our own propaganda. But it isn't just the Israelis who have that problem. It's also the Americans and the NATO people. They're living in a propaganda bubble created by this Western media that's owned by a shrinking handful of oligarchs. And that media was already largely a loose tool of this Western billionaire oligarchy, and it's been that way for well over a century. But then in World War II, the CIA was formed as a kind of an action wing of Wall Street, and they then infiltrated the US media in the 1950s. And so this loose kind of assortment of TV, news outlets, and so on, are owned by a bunch of billionaires who sometimes work together and sometimes don't, got concentrated both into the American and NATO national security complex through Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's takeover of the American media, but also through consolidation as a shrinking number of billionaires bought up the media. And of course, perhaps the majority, certainly close to it, of those billionaires and the key people in the media happen to be of Jewish ethnicity and have some degree of loyalty to the State of Israel. So we have a media that is living in its own propaganda bubble. It's pro-Israeli, it's pro-NATO, and they actually tend to believe their own lies. And that's why their policies aren't working, because they actually believe that all the people of Iran are yearning to be ruled by MEK terrorists. And these sorts of nonsensical propaganda talking points end up actually being believed by some of the policymakers. Mm-hmm. So when you believe your own lies, you're not going to be making smart moves on the international chess game. And so the empire is making stupid move after stupid move, bringing China and Russia and Iran and other countries together in Eurasia to oppose this North American-based Anglo-Zionist empire. This strategy is insane, but they're so locked up in their propaganda bubble, believing their own lies, that they imagine that they can conquer the world for freedom and democracy, and incidentally, the billionaire oligarchs who own everything in the West. And it's insane, and they're losing. They lost in Iraq. They lost in Afghanistan. They're going to lose in Syria. They're going to lose in Ukraine. They're going to lose in the South China Sea and Taiwan. This empire is going down, and it's largely because they're too stupid to get out of their propaganda bubble.
All right. Appreciate your comments. Kevin Barrett, author and Middle East expert in there. Now, moving on, the Iranian president is urging all Islamic states to give the issue of Palestine a priority. Ibrahim Raisi, however, criticized a number of Arab countries for normalizing ties with the Tel Aviv regime. He says that those that normalize ties with Israel are wrong to think that a country will give them protection and security. He says that such moves have not only compounded the problems of those governments, they've also added to the problems of the region as a whole. Raisi described normalization pacts as weak and said that some countries are part of the West's political games that intend to target Palestinian resistance. The president stressed that unity among all Palestinian factions is key to victory against Israel. He was speaking with Palestine's new ambassador to Tehran, Salam Zawawi, who submitted her credentials to the president. Moving on, Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians during an attack in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. A Palestinian resistance group, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, says that the three victims were its members. The regime forces claim that the trio were responsible for several shooting attacks over the past weeks. They were targeted by the Israeli special forces, who intercepted their car and started shooting at them. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the three deaths, calling the Israeli operation an assassination. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also condemned the killing as a field execution. In other news, the U.S. is sending more troops to Eastern Europe amid a standoff with Russia over Ukraine. The latest batch of soldiers has arrived in Romania.
More than 100 American soldiers have come for training, specialists who are preparing for the future deployment of troops. They have arrived in Romania. They have also arrived in other countries, for example, in Poland. Together with our logistics specialists, they will work on this in the coming days. This means it will not be long before the rest of the troops arrive.
The Pentagon also deployed hundreds of elite forces and military vehicles to Poland over the past few days. In total, some 3,000 American troops will deploy to Romania and Poland. U.S. allies, including France, Germany, and Britain, also planning to send hundreds of reinforcement troops to Eastern Europe, citing a potential Russian attack on Ukraine. And Moscow says NATO is using the narrative of invasion on Ukraine as a pretext for its eastward expansion. Meantime, French President Emmanuel Macron has met with his Ukrainian counterpart in Kiev in a bid to defuse tensions. On Monday, Macron held talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Canadian truckers opposed the government's COVID measures remain in the streets of the capital, Ottawa, despite the declaration of a state of emergency by the city mayor. Trucks and other vehicles blocked the city center, causing a gridlock for days. Protesters appear to have calmed after the emergency, which the mayor said was for the safety of residents. On Monday, Parliament held an emergency session to deal with the issue. Addressing the session, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau demanded an end to the demonstration. Protests have been ongoing for 12 days. Truckers and other motorists started the so-called Freedom Convoy and their opposition to a vaccine mandate for cross-border drivers, but it has since snowballed into anger at the government's COVID-related policies. The UN World Food Program says millions of people in countries across the Horn of Africa are facing severe hunger as the region is witnessing its worst drought in two decades.
After three failed rainy seasons, the Horn of Africa is in the midst of a severe drought affecting up to 13 million people. Southern Ethiopia, northern Kenya and Somalia are impacted. Livestock are dying, crops are failing, and populations are being forced from their homes.
Around 6 million people are in need of food assistance in southern Ethiopia alone, and that includes 500,000 malnourished children. In Somalia, the UN agency says that the number of people in need of food aid will rise to nearly 5 million by May if immediate action is not taken. Another 2.8 million people in Kenya require assistance as authorities there declared a drought emergency in September last year. The UN agency says that the situation needs measures to avoid a repeat of a famine that killed hundreds of thousands of people a decade ago. The WFP says it needs nearly $330 million to respond to urgent needs over the next 6 months. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We will be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
حالا من یک چه کار بکنم به جنگ خدا رفتم با این همه نعمت هایی که لا تو عده و لا تو سا چکا کنم معصیت کردم جنگ خدا
What does it mean when we say we are at war with Allah? This sentence means that I violated Allah's orders although he bestowed me many blessings. Committing sins means fighting Allah. Having a look at stranger women means being at war with Allah. Backbiting and slandering means fighting Allah. If I do any of these forbidden acts, I am in fact fighting Allah. Allah has ordered me not to do these acts, but I am doing them. I am violating his rules on earth. Is this the meaning of thankfulness towards the blessings that Allah bestowed upon me? We must befriend Allah instead of being his enemy. Allah is the best of friends. You can find nowhere a friend like him. He is the best of forgivers too. If you do something wrong and ask for his mercy, he for sure will forgive you. Thus, let's befriend Allah and do not fight him with violating his rules. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasir. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Is the UK's ambulance service in crisis? Recent news reports have revealed there are now too few crews to keep up with demand and the close to million calls they get every month. Despite limited resources, the ambulance crews are doing their best, but they know there is little prospect of a reduction in the massive pressures they have to endure every day.
Dealing with the increased number of calls caused by COVID has made the problems worse. However, the underlying issues are related to a rise in general demand for ambulance services and a fall in those currently employed to deliver it. Thousands of paramedics have left the ambulance service, leading to a shortfall that those who remain must try and cope with. The impact is clear and concerning. The service struggles to cope with demand, and as a result, ambulance service crews are regularly missing the time targets set for them. This in turn is increasing the level of stress on those who remain in the ambulance service. Indeed, stress-related illness amongst paramedics has gone up, with reported cases in the service increasing by 71% during the coronavirus pandemic.
How would it feel to wait for hours for an ambulance to arrive? And are the public concerned about a potentially growing shortage of ambulance crews for the winter ahead? Simple questions with important answers. Now let's start with this. Over the last 2 years, thousands of paramedics have left the service. How does the public feel about that? We put it to them outside this major hospital in London. Here's what they told us.
I feel that it takes a toll and effect on people because people are needing help. They've got no source of transport, no support, nothing to get to a hospital, you know. And some people live by themselves or are single parents, whatever. They've got no one to help them there.
They're understaffed and they should be properly funded, and there should be the money's there, so there should be the right funding for the right sectors. And if the money's there, then where's this money going? It's not to the right places.
Well, I think the government would need to do something about that because there are a lot of people that do need healthcare services. And I think they need to recruit more drivers.
I think that's bad because like ambulances are very important, and like if it takes long, it can affect someone's chance of surviving. So that's not a good thing.
It makes me feel quite upset. But I think that we need those people, that those are the most vital people in life, basically, in every country. So, yeah, like we definitely need to get those numbers back so people can fill in those positions.
Well, I think I can understand it. I'm surprised that they've been able to cope as well as they seem to have, you know, over the past 18 months. It seems to be just relentless and quite thankless, too. You know, you hear about aggression towards ambulance drivers and that, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it's probably it is sad, but I guess it's all the pressure that's on them. You know, dealing with social issues as well as the
concerned for sure because of safety. If we need service, what do we do? How do we go about it and get treated? You know, and so on. So yeah. But also I'm a bit more concerned about the level of violence towards them too.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard good things. I don't really know much about it. It seems pretty easy to get services. I know getting vaccinated was kind of difficult for some of my friends, which was like it was a priority for them to get vaccinated. So I think that might have been difficult. But yeah, I guess other than that, I've been able to access all the services I need. So, and as someone who's not actually...
A bit concerning, to be honest. I only had one personal experience where I've had to call an ambulance in the UK, and I did find that the wait time was already quite long. So I think if there's any further reductions, it's just going to get worse and worse, and people are going to be waiting longer and longer. It's hard enough, as is, I think, with London, especially because of the traffic. It's hard to get ambulance to places they need to be with enough of them on the road, let alone if they remove some of them. So
it's scary because, like, we need the NHS. Like, we need a lot of people can't afford privatised healthcare. So, like, having fewer ambulances means, like, probably more deaths, more, like, things that could have been prevented if we did have the right amount of funding and for the NHS and the ambulance.
The fact that there are fewer ambulance staff, I mean, I haven't ever needed any ambulance resource, but my first instinct is that it sounds like it's something that's critical.
Well, I used to be a care worker myself, so that wasn't for the NHS, though I have worked for the NHS since. But the main issue is really low rates of pay, long hours, not very much encouragement, and a climate that whatever you do, it's going to be wrong.
I need to see the data to say if it's right or not, because I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that the waiting time is longer to just get to the GP, that's for sure. At the same time, you know, if we want to have more staff, then we need to allocate more resources to that. And then, well, the funding obviously will have to change, so we need to cut it from somewhere else or collect more in taxes. So that's, you know.
Why can't the NHS retain enough staff to run the ambulance service? Here's the public's opinion.
Many, many things, many reasons come to mind. You know, pay, level of working conditions, level of pay, treatment by others, the attacks on people. The list goes on.
I'd say it would be a combination of things, like probably to do with pay, maybe something to do with Brexit as well, and probably just a whole different range of things.
I think probably burnout. You know, I think the best of times, it's quite a difficult job to, you know, it's not like going to your job and then just going home again. I think, you know, they're in there for long hours and they see a lot of difficult situations, and it's probably very hard for them to switch off. So if they're being overstretched, I imagine mentally it would be very difficult to cope, apart from any of the other, you know, aggressions that they might face during the job, you know, which would discourage them.
I guess because it's like an extremely under strain situation, and people aren't probably don't feel especially valued.
I mean, I've been in the Canadian system since I was born, so I've never had any health issues either, so I can't really speak to that. But I think it's so far it's been quicker to get tests and prescriptions that I need here than it has been at home. So that's something, I guess, yeah.
I think especially in the past year with coronavirus, they've been under a lot of stress. It's been very difficult for a lot of those staff. It might be that some of them can't take the pressure of it anymore, and they're just not getting the same treatment and respect that they should be getting. So, probably looking for a different job.
I feel like it could be a danger, but I feel like it could be, like, easy sword as well. Because, like, obviously with Corona, it was affected a lot, but I feel like we can bounce back from that. So I feel like it could get back to a good position.
I think it's the government. I feel like the funding for the NHS, including the ambulance and, like, everything like that, the government is cutting down on, and we need to, like, increase the budget and for the NHS.
I can only assume the recent 2 years where I think people have been working under such stress without recovery time, with a lot of anxiety, and I get the impression that there's not very much resource and there's not very much support for them.
There's a lot of competition for jobs out there, pay's not very good, but the NHS costs the government a great deal of money, and I would imagine the government is struggling to find enough money to pay for all that, so it's in the same problem as a lot of employers have, which is finding enough money to pay wages that will attract people and get them to stay. It's not an easy problem to solve.
I'm not sure if it's less and less in people wanting to work for there. I think the demand is just higher. I think there's more and more people who need it, and I think the supply just doesn't meet it of the work stuff, but maybe there is less of people working as well. But for sure, I think there's just more people like coming to the UK in general.
It's stress from probably overwork and the amount of work that's expected from them, and you know, trying to keep a brave face for the people that they're dealing with. Yeah.
I think there's something secretly going on that the public don't know about. As we all know, government always hides a bit more than what we know. Obviously, they're not getting paid enough for the great work they do. Though I can't say I know, but you can tell from
of an outside point of view that something is not going right.
Yeah, stress, underfunding, severe underfunding, cuts, and it's one thing when the NHS is not properly funded, and another when Boris and his mates can just get their pay rises, and then so obviously the money's there because you know it's there. You can see where the money's going, and it's not going in the right places. So I imagine that if they don't feel appreciated, what was it last year? People were on their doorsteps clapping for them. It's like that's all well and good, but it's just gestures at the end of the day, and they should be properly paid, and maybe then they wouldn't be having to leave.
Possibly because everybody wants to be safe and stay alive for their families. It might have something to do with the wages that they're being paid. Maybe the government needs to think about increasing their wages, and that might possibly retain the staff.
Yeah, probably stress and pay and everything as well. Maybe abroad they might get better money and things like that, possibly.
We're heading into winter, and ambulance professionals are warning that things will get worse.
Yeah, again, it's very concerning if that is the case, where there's more and more people leaving the profession and there's not enough people to actually backfill them. It's naturally concerning to anybody, really, and I think whoever are the policy makers need to do something about it to address that issue and be a little bit more transparent about it.
Regarding to your question, I just think that NHS did a lot for our country or from all the citizens of this country and for everyone. They looking after everyone like we are their own family, and also they maybe they are fed up a little bit like everyone, because if they are working too much and their work is not appreciated, obviously they are fed like a bit tired, just keeping working hard and maintain our healthy and to protect us. So it's like they're doing a really hard job for us to keeping everybody safe. And I think like everyone, they, before of their duties and their job, they are human exactly like us. So I think they are a bit tired at the moment because they was working too hard to keeping everybody safe.
I mean, it's a little bit concerning. I know that people who work paramedics and people who work in that field are extremely valuable, and I think it's really important to pay them what they deserve, make sure that they have good working conditions, and do whatever's necessary to make sure that those services are accessible and available to people.
It's going to take a toll, and it's going to get scary. As you know, we're in a pandemic, and the crime is getting worse. Even the police, not just the ambulance, the police, they don't answer for hours. Imagine you're calling the police asking for help, you're going to get stabbed or anything, and they don't answer. You're on a one-hour hold, and then no one comes. Just like the ambulance. Your life is gone within seconds.
Oh, it's terrible. It's really horrible because, we live in like a progressive country where we should have these services already available, and the fact that they're not shows you something about the current state of this country.
That would be really devastating to know that, on the other line of the telephone, if you call 999, there's nobody to pick up the call. We do need that support, and we do pay our taxes for these services, so they should be made available.
I think there needs to be better methods of getting the ambulances to where they need to be, whether it's certain response roads or things like that that allow emergency services to access routes that cars and general traffic might not be able to use, or something along those lines that just allows them to get where they need to be faster.
I just feel like totally just hurt, just like thinking that it didn't have to be like this, and just wishing that there would be someone there to come to the scene as soon as possible, because a lot of times I know many people that's been in positions where they had to wait loads of minutes for ambulance to come. So it's like not everyone has a car to get to the ambulance as well, so it's kind of hard. You might have to find different ways of transportation, and with the stress of having to deal with whoever you're dealing with at the moment, that's kind of hard to do. So
Well, it's a very unpleasant thought. I mean, I actually needed to call an ambulance just 2 days ago, and I was incredibly lucky, I suppose, because there was somebody there within 25 minutes. And that's when things are sort of quite difficult at the moment. it would be nice to think that there'll be a way to sort of supplement the service that they're providing at the moment. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, my case wasn't particularly life-threatening, but I imagine if you're lying there with a broken leg or something, I mean, that's going to be a very difficult situation for people to deal with.
It'd be awful, you know, to be in that position. But, you know, it's something that needs to be addressed along with all the other social care issues that are needs to be addressed by government, yeah.
It does, because it's putting family, loved ones at risk. When you are in need, nobody is coming.
Let's look at the facts, and the statistics tell a story of concern. Since 2018, the number of paramedics has fallen from 32,200 to 28,700. Largely because of this, emergency call-out waiting times are on average 9 minutes instead of the target 7 minutes. Less serious call-out times are 46 minutes versus the 18-minute target. And non-emergency waiting times can reach as much as 7.5 hours, with one patient held in an ambulance in the west of England for 11 hours and 46 minutes.
How would people here in London feel if they had to wait for up to 7.5 hours for an ambulance to arrive?
It's happened to me so many times, I don't call ambulance again. Really? I just get a taxi.
I'd be really like upset if I had to wait that length of time for an ambulance. Like, I have had to wait long for, like, I've called an ambulance before and had to wait 4 hours, so, but that wasn't an emergency one, so.
That's inexcusable, really. And there was another case I heard about the other day, and it was even longer than that, and the person died as a result of it. I think it was a heart problem. By the time they actually got to where they needed to get him, it was too late. So I think for a country that has the wealth of Britain, this shouldn't be happening. I think there must be a way around it. I mean, I lived in Germany for many years. I don't think in Germany this would be acceptable. It just, they would find a way to cope with whatever shortages that they have.
Be angry and, you know, yeah, and just worrying about your own health and, yeah, knowing that help isn't, usually you associate the ambulance should be with you in 7 to 8 minutes, but are those days gone? That's, you know, yeah, be very angry, yeah.
I feel sad because I live by myself. I feel sad because you feel like no one cares about you, and you feel like the only people that would care about you, the ambulance, unfortunately, they can't be there.
It's terrible, obviously. If you have an illness or a problem, if you're sick, you need to go to the hospital, then, it's not like in the States where you'd have to pay to go for the ambulance. You know, like, I hear a lot of stories when they say if you're pregnant in the States, then you have to pay for the ambulance, so people would rather pay for an Uber. It's like, imagine having to pay for a taxi to take you to the ambulance when the ambulance should be provided there, because you pay all this tax money, and where's it going?
Really scared, because like I said, some families and some people, some individuals are home alone. They have no families, you know, so they rely on the public health service to be there for them in times of emergencies, really.
What's the public's message to government about the growing emergency in the ambulance services?
I think from a government point of view, the NHS is complex because of its size. We often talk about the inefficiencies, but it's more than that. It seems many of them are underpaid. That has to be resolved. I think they need a lot of softer support. They need their own therapies and coaching to help them with the traumas that they've been through. And as a member of the public, I've no idea.
I think supporting them as a government, listening to their complaints or comments about working conditions, hours that they work, support in terms of infrastructure that they need, and at least considering it before kind of going ahead with any sort of political agenda.
Well, I'd like them to say step up and, you know, just get with it. You know, look at what's happening out and don't sort of hide behind it. Don't be shy about it. You know, look at this, what's going on, and put some investment behind it.
Our message is to government is to basically come together and find different ways how you can promote the job for the ambulance drivers, and just basically use everything you have to try and make people want to come and work for the ambulance, and don't like, respect them as well.
So look at their hours, look at the work that they do, the work that's expected of them, and you know, offer them more flexible hours, more training, and more, yeah, just more help generally.
The job is very stressful, and is well underpaid. So the government needs to pay people well, and make sure that the working environment is safe. Also, the people need to relax about people who work in the NHS, because when they see something on social, they take it too seriously. The job is stressful, people need to de-stress, and people do things differently.
Well, I think they may find that people start becoming more active in their unhappiness with the situation. You know, I'm not sort of suggesting that people become more aggressive, but I think some kind of popular action is probably going to happen sooner or later, because people are being pressed in so many areas. And this is possibly going to be, you know, just the final straw for a lot of people.
Recruit more staffs, pay good wages, and hopefully the staff members would stay.
My message to the government is fix up. Stop caring about people, because you really care about your money. That's it, you care about how your family is and everything like that, and your government, whatever. But how about the civilians? Because we make up the country, we make up the world. You know, they care about themselves, until one day it's going to fall back on them. You know, that's my message to the government, is fix up.
There is no doubt the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the underlying issues which the ambulance service has been dealing with. Continued decline in the number of paramedics available. It is also clear that the psychological effects on those who remain continue to cause increasing concern. There have even been reports of suicide in the service. The NHS is often described as a crowning achievement of the British state. For decades, it has served the public all year round. But with falling numbers of paramedics and almost a million calls a month, demand simply exceeds supply. As we head towards a potentially troubling winter rise in those calls, the evidence suggests that the UK Emergency Ambulance Service is on the verge of declaring an emergency of its own.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.